This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Today on the program, now nobody gets to go to Barcelona for the big telecom show, the price of paying off a ton of student loans, and whether Instagram creators deserve a cut. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, February 13th, and it is good to be with you today. We've been talking all week about the financial consequences of the coronavirus, and here is one big international example. The Mobile World Congress, which is the largest trade show in the mobile and telecom industries, canceled this month's event in Barcelona because of virus fears. There are lots of ways to think about the cost of cancellation. 100,000 visitors no longer flying into Barcelona or spending $500 million there. And Marketplace's Scott Tong has some other costs that are harder to measure.
Mobile industry analyst Avi Greengart runs his own company in New Jersey. The cost to him of a canceled Mobile World Congress?
I've lost about $3,000 in non-refundable travel expenses.
But he says the bigger losses are the insights, the light bulb moments from back-to-back conversations.
When you're meeting with a whole bunch of companies doing the same kind of thing, you can tease out trends that you might not have been able to have gotten from one meeting 1 week, another meeting 2 months later.
For a small business like his, the trade show is a once-a-year chance to connect with device makers or carriers from Brazil or India, Finland, China. It's also an efficient way to step out of the garage, as it were, says marketing consultant Dory Clark.
So often in the tech field, you are in heads-down mode, and all you can do is what is immediately in front of you. A conference is the opportunity to take the pulse for a moment of new trends. You go into heads-up mode.
Now, for the big mobile companies that spend millions each year in Barcelona on marketing, cancellation means they're missing out on discovery, says Roger Entner at Recon Analytics.
This discovery process of finding new ideas for the big companies is an incalculable loss because they are relying on innovation from small companies to be competitive.
To be sure, the mobile industry is good at conference calls, but Entner says in-person handshakes that lead to deals don't happen on Zoom or Skype. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Now for another story with a big price tag. I believe you know by now that Americans have a lot of student loan debt. And many people are paying down that debt with something called an income-based repayment plan. That's where your payments are based on, yes, your income. And you pay a percentage of that income every month. And then if, after 20 to 25 years, you haven't paid off those loans, the government will toss what remains of your IOU into the trash. But so how much is that going to cost the government, as in taxpayers? The Congressional Budget Office put out a report answering that very question yesterday. And the number is around $207 billion over the next decade. Wow. Marketplace's Justin Ho reports.
It might sound like the government's issuing a get-out-of-jail-free card for all student borrowers. But Justin Drager at the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators says graduate students stand to benefit the most.
There are less subsidies, less grants available for graduate students, and there are more high-cost programs for graduate students.
The CBO report says grad students on income-based repayment plans owe $92,000 on average, five times what an undergraduate on the same plan owes. And over the last decade, the percentage of grad students participating in the program has grown sixfold. Drager says while the program was meant to be a safety net for students,
if more students are needing this safety net, then it should be a warning signal that we have distress in the student loan market.
Part of the issue is that a lot of graduate programs don't lead to high-earning jobs, says Antoinette Flores at the Center for American Progress.
You have people like social workers and teachers who may already have undergraduate debt. and they are going into a field where the earnings are relatively low.
Borrowers on income-based repayment plans typically pay off their loans using 10 to 15% of their discretionary income each month. That's often barely enough to make a dent in what they owe, says Jason Delisle at the American Enterprise Institute.
The payments are very low relative to what people are borrowing and relative to the term before they would have the debt forgiven.
The CBO estimates that by the end of the decade, 81% of the government's $200 billion in student loan forgiveness will go to graduate students. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, speaking of telecom, the federal government has officially accused Chinese telecom maker Huawei of racketeering and theft. But telecom stocks are so bummed about Barcelona that the competition barely noticed. More on that and other moves when we do the numbers. In today's age of information and disinformation, it's hard to know where a free open source site like Wikipedia fits in. Students and journalists are taught never to use it as a source, but then again, the volunteers who work on it do it only for the love of the information. So where does Wikipedia fit into our news and social media landscape? And is it vulnerable to the same disinformation campaigns as other online platforms? Catherine Marr is the CEO and Executive Director of the Wikimedia Foundation. She's here with us. Welcome, Catherine.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I want to talk to you a lot about information, you know, at this time when disinformation is almost like the currency of the web. Do you ever face these sort of concentrated, I don't even know what it would be, like a spam campaign that says that this particular piece of misinformation should definitely appear on Wikipedia?
Absolutely. There are efforts at times with groups of individuals will try to manipulate the quality of the information towards a particular aim. It actually only takes one person who is tracking that article page to be able to shut that down. So any page on Wikipedia can be temporarily paused from future editing and rolled back to the most accurate version by an editor who has sort of standing in the community and is respected by their peers. And what that means is that we actually have the ability within the system to sort of self-regulate when there's an effort to actively manipulate information.
Is it possible that some of the concern then going forward is less about errors and more about omission?
Absolutely. I think that Wikipedia currently is, the editor balance is roughly sort of best numbers 80% male. And what that leads to is implicit bias in terms of what gets covered and what is deemed as notable. Right now, the content on most Wikipedias, particularly in sort of the subject area of biographies, is skewed towards men. So about just under 20% of biographies on English Wikipedia are about women. And that's one of those places where Wikipedia editors are actually really interested in trying to correct the record. So the way that Wikimedia works is you've got groups of volunteers that self-organize and run projects like Women in Red, which is a campaign to write women into Wikipedia. The reason this matters so much is a lot of those products that are coming out of the technology sector today are trained on Wikipedia.
Hmm. Go back to sort of this question of like trying to identify bias. We can break it into a couple points.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you have a database that overrepresents men or overrepresents certain concepts like science to be associated with men, what you're actually doing is encoding those biases into the world around you. And unlike Wikipedia, which at least we know to take with a critical eye, we know it's a work in progress, we know it's not done, that's not the case when we're using most products and features that are built into the web today. It's very hard to identify the bias when it's at the level of code.
And then finally, how do you see the role of Wikimedia right now as having evolved in a significant way as sort of politics and culture really shift around the idea of truth, around what a fact is? What role do you have to play going forward?
It's funny, when I started at Wikimedia Foundation, I always thought, oh, this job will be so interesting. I never expected it to be quite so relevant. I think what has changed for us is we've gone from being sort of a website on the internet to a way in which the world records itself, the way in which the world reflects back, you know, whether it's our biases around gender or whether it's about important political debates of the day, all of this happens on Wikipedia's sites. And because it has become more central to the way that the web processes knowledge, in terms of the sort of centrality ability to search results, but also, as I mentioned earlier, training for machine learning and AI, you know, we've become much more of a sort of central record of information that underpins the knowledge infrastructure of the web, which makes it all the more important from our perspective to steward it on behalf of the public interest, because it really is a resource that belongs to the whole world. And we have a responsibility to make sure that that stays that way.
Catherine Marr is Chief Executive Officer of the Wikimedia Foundation. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Yeah, thanks so much, Molly. It's been a pleasure.
If you're searching for a hot career with lots of job openings, look no further than the aviation industry. Over the next two decades, there will be a lot more planes flying a lot more places, especially in Southeast Asia and India. One big problem, though, there aren't actually enough pilots. It can take years to properly train a commercial pilot, so how to get enough of them in the air without compromising safety? The BBC's Monica Miller reports from the Singapore Air Show.
Drops clear!
Erica Diane Hira is getting a jump start on her new career as a commercial pilot. She kicks the tires of a Cessna 172 Skyhawk and goes over every inch of the single-engine plane before slipping her petite frame into her seat. The 23-year-old decided not to pursue a career in medicine like the rest of her family and instead follow her passion. But she initially had some doubts.
I thought that this male-dominated industry was too hard on females, and most significantly, because I was short, I did not know if I could fly a plane or even step on the rudders or, most importantly, the brakes.
The Asia-Pacific region has seen a boom of low-cost carriers and millions of first-time flyers, but the small pool of qualified commercial pilots isn't meeting demand. In fact, Boeing says globally, airlines will need more than 800,000 new pilots in less than 20 years. Roughly one-third of those jobs will be in Asia. So how did the industry find itself in this place?
In the historical days of the airlines in the States and in Europe, you had these big, you know, Western militaries, and they'd produce a lot of combat pilots, you know, guys with skills in pilot combat planes and transports. So there was a lot of opportunities for ex-military guys who had a lot of experience with aircraft to go into the commercial airliner business.
That's Greg Waldron from Flight Global. He says Asia is a different story.
The militaries in the region do produce some pilots, but they're not growing, and they tend to be rather small. And the amount of people retiring from these air forces doesn't nearly meet the demand that you're going to see from, you know, the airlines for new pilots. So typically, you can get people going to flying schools around the region, sometimes at their own expense, sometimes, you know, the airline will pay for it.
B596, Cessna 172 from Dornier Hangar, request staff instruction, Charlie 1.
Major airline manufacturers like Boeing and Airbus require 200 cockpit hours with additional simulation training. But some airlines are trying to change those rules. Captain Manuel Ferranda from Alpha Aviation Group says there's a different type of pilot's license that depends more on simulation training and less hours in the sky.
They just undergo around 70 hours basic training. They call it core flying in a single engine aircraft. The technology now is really priming up. We are now going to a level where flying is digital.
But as recent incidents have shown us, pilots only have a split second to make a life or death decision. A design flaw is blamed for Boeing 737 MAX crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia that killed 346 people. Aviation analyst Greg Waldron says that the crashes also raised red flags about regulations and pilot training.
Being a pilot, 99.99% of the time, it's all very routine, very boring, very stable. But then you have this 0.0001% of the time that you really earn your money as a pilot, and they have to be ready.
4-6 coordinates with your company aircraft.
Until the hiring gap shrinks, pilots will face growing pressure to meet the industry's demands. In Pampanga, the Philippines, I'm the BBC's Monica Miller for Marketplace.
Coming up,
if the worst were to happen, we've made decisions when we're at this apex of our love.
A prenup love story. But first, let's do the numbers. She goes up, she goes down. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 128 points, 0.4% to close at 29,423. The NASDAQ slipped 13 points, that's 0.1% to finish at 97.11. And the S&P 500 fell 5 points, also 0.1%. To end at 3373. A federal judge ordered Microsoft to stop working on a defense contract worth $10 billion. That was big news today. Amazon sued after it didn't get the cloud computing deal, saying President Trump was biased against its founder, Jeff Bezos. Microsoft shares clicked down 0.5%. Amazon shrank 0.4%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.61%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, y'all. I'm Rima Khres, host of Marketplace's podcast, This is Uncomfortable. And this week on the pod, we're looking at a pretty heavy but important topic, financial abuse. Because research shows that financial abuse occurs in 99% of domestic violence cases.
Everybody always says the same stupid question. Why doesn't she just leave? You know, why doesn't she just leave? You know, nobody says, why is he doing it? But Why doesn't she just leave? Because it's not that simple. It's never that simple.
We get into the complicated decision of leaving an abusive relationship when you have little to no money. Episode drops on Thursday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Now, we kind of knew that for a lot of people, Instagram is way more popular than its parent company, Facebook. But according to a recent report in Bloomberg, in 2019, Instagram's ad revenue was $20 billion, more than a quarter of Facebook's total earnings. And that is money that some of Instagram's users think they should get a chunk of. Sarah Fryer at Bloomberg first reported that $20 billion number, and she joins me now. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
How does Instagram make money? Is it just ads?
Instagram makes money the same way Facebook does, by putting ads in the feed that users are seeing their regular friends' content. And they also have started slotting ads in Instagram stories, which are the posts that disappear after 24 hours.
Everyone I know is buying stuff they saw on Instagram, including me. Like, those ads are really, really good. Is there a sense that somehow Facebook has cracked the nut on targeting ads on Instagram in a way that, like, no other property has?
Well, the thing about Instagram is it's extremely visual. So I think people notice ads more. So when you're looking at Instagram, you're looking to be in this experience of being sold to, even by your friends. Your friends are selling you a lifestyle or a vacation they're on or a date they went to. Instagram doesn't actually share its revenue with creators for the most part. They've only just started to pay for some limited content on Instagram TV. I would say that Instagram is more efficient at monetizing.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that is a big question, because certainly creators have become a bigger and bigger part of the Instagram experience, and arguably a big driver of it. And there have been, you know, arguments that maybe Instagram needs to forge a better relationship with its creators or share some revenue with them. Is this kind of an argument that, like, maybe don't, maybe no, they don't?
Well, I got a lot of messages yesterday from Instagram creators who said that this is, seems really unfair to them. They didn't expect that Instagram made this much in revenue, but now that they know, they really want a piece of it because they feel like they are creating the value for the platform that gets Instagram users to keep coming back. And I think one way that this might happen this year is Instagram is going to start letting people sell their products directly through the app. The way people currently make money if they have a following on Instagram is through these unofficial relationships. They can say, I'm a travel influencer, I'm going to Bali, these hotels will give me free stay. All these people will come together in an unofficial relationship to pay me for this experience that I can gain following from.
Is there really any upside for Instagram to create those direct relationships? Certainly YouTube has come under fire, you know, for incubating controversial creators, for example. Like, could it just be cleaner for Instagram to say, thanks, make your own money on your own?
I think it's definitely something that they are concerned about. Instagram, in its initial conversations with people to allow them to be paid to create content for Instagram TV, had a clause in the contract that said that they weren't allowed to talk about anything controversial, no politics, no race stuff, nothing that would, you know, maybe be something that Instagram didn't want to put its money behind. So what is happening with their brand maintenance is they're trying to make sure that if they get into these close relationships with creators, that they don't do it in a sloppy way.
Sarah Fryer is a reporter for Bloomberg who broke the scoop on Instagram's revenue. Sarah, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Speaking of creators and brand relationships, the Federal Trade Commission said yesterday that it's looking at creating tougher guidelines around creator endorsements. In fact, one commissioner referred to those as, quote, illegal payola. Valentine's Day is just about here, and wouldn't you know it, we've got a love story for you about prenuptial agreements. Prenups. No, I promise, this is a love story. Prenups, of course, are those contracts between engaged couples that specify how all the money and assets would get divided if things don't work out. And despite their long-standing bad news connotation, prenups are kind of trendy now. Millennials are actually requesting them. From our podcast, This is Uncomfortable, here's Rima Grace.
Erin Lowry and her boyfriend were out walking their dog one evening when she asked him this question that felt super out of left field.
I just remember saying that I thought prenups were a good idea. What did you think?
In that moment, her boyfriend, Joe, says he just felt confused.
Probably the only time that I had heard a prenup was, you know, like celebrities getting them. And like when there's just like massive amounts of money, you know, in a marriage.
He didn't think people like them got prenups. He's a high school social studies teacher, and Aaron is a personal finance writer who runs a brand called Broke Millennial. Meanwhile, Aaron felt like pretty much everyone should get a prenup.
So my feeling on a prenup is that there is already laws and rules in place of how to, you know, split up assets if you were to get divorced. So I would prefer to be in control of that situation as opposed to letting the state of New York decide for me.
It was a compelling argument, but Joe was still a little unsure.
The thought that came to my mind was like, all right, we're not even engaged yet. And, you know, we're now having a conversation about what's going to happen if we get divorced.
It's not that I think we're going to get divorced. Just like, I don't think our apartment's going to burn down, but I still have renter's insurance.
Aaron eventually convinced him. And about a year later, Joe proposed, they celebrated, and then they each hired their own attorney to draft a prenup. They decided if they got a divorce, what's earned during the marriage would be split 50-50. But anything earned afterwards, they'd keep for themselves. And that was especially important for Erin. As a writer, she didn't want Joe to be entitled to a portion of her book royalties indefinitely.
It made me nervous to think about how things would get split and divided in a way that might seem okay under the eyes of state law based on people who work two traditional jobs, but I'm self-employed, so I wanted protection.
Every now and then, prenups can also include some pretty wild clauses, like financial penalties for cheating or protecting intellectual property, you know, like a cool idea for an app. For Aaron and Joe, things felt especially tense when they talked about hypotheticals, like if one day they inherited money. Just the thought of that led to conversations like this.
Well, if I were to inherit money and that money got used to purchase a house, I would never allow you to be living in that house if we got divorced. The idea of some other woman living in this house with you that my parents' money helped to buy, oof, that just riles me up. I think that's the only time I got emotional, like truly emotional.
Yeah, you felt a certain way about that, yeah.
They agreed that if either of them get an inheritance and used it to buy, say, a car or a house, the percentage of whatever they contributed would go back to the person who inherited the money.
Now, if we had children, that might change this entire conversation.
Yeah.
That could change the whole thing.
And if that happens, they plan to update their agreement, you know, get a postnup.
I feel like it must have been really weird and maybe even surreal, like sitting down with someone you love, you know, sort of imagining the details of a future without them.
Yeah,
and what's yours
that's
and what's
painful.
Theirs.
That's why I think I had such a reaction to it all. This is a world in which we have gotten divorced and we're no longer loving each other and with each other.
Ultimately, crafting the prenup cost them about $4,000 in lawyers' fees. For Aaron and Joe, they're thankful, though, it forced them to have really difficult money conversations early on. And, I don't know, their argument for it is pretty convincing.
Hey, this is a way that if the worst were to happen, we've made decisions when we're at this apex of our love.
Right. And we did have arguments about this. But it's like, well, let's have these mini arguments now while we're still totally in love.
They've been married now for about a year, and that prenup is tucked away somewhere safe, a lovingly crafted plan for the future they hope they'll never need. I'm Rima Khres for Marketplace.
This final note before we go, another story of information in America in two parts. Part one, newspaper group McClatchy has filed for bankruptcy. The company runs newspapers in 14 states, including the Kansas City Star. Now, as it happens, this is part two, some new programming recently showed up on Kansas City area radio stations. Radio Sputnik, a propaganda division of the Russian government. The guy who owns those Kansas City stations running the paid anti-American programming said, "Hey, man, this is America. We got free speech and we got capitalism." All right, that's it for me. Today, the Dow lost 128 points. That was 0.4%. The NASDAQ down 13 points, about 0.1%. And the S&P 500 fell 5 points. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, and John Gordon are the Marketplace editing staff. Betsy Streisand is the managing editor. And I'm Molly Wood. Kai Rizdahl is back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.